days I fail to lose presence in my soul. That day Islam took me in its fold.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing the age of three and how in this phase of the children's lives they become curious a lot and they begin asking questions. Dear Sayyid, please enlighten us further.
So we said the child at this age, for example, he asks a lot of questions, he listens to the answers, sometimes he understands them, sometimes he doesn't, depending on how you give it to him, but nevertheless, he listens. That's the thing, right? I remember...
It's actually true. Always,
yeah, I remember one little child once asked me about who made God. Right. Now, I looked at him and I didn't know what to say to this child, so I had to, I don't know, bring an example with toys and robots to explain to him who created God,
right?
Or if God is created to begin with. And then I met this child like years later. He was old enough. He was, I don't know, about in his 15, 16. And I said to him, remember you asked me that question? He's like, I remember I asked you the question. And I remember the answer that you gave
me. He remembers.
And I said, SubhanAllah, see? So the child, even though he's very young, but the answer, you give him the answer, you might think that the child did not understand you. And true, maybe he didn't at that time.
Right.
But nevertheless, he listens. It stays with him. So you try to give him answers as much as you can without shutting him down, especially when it comes to questions of aqa'id.
Theological answers or beliefs.
Because this is the age where they ask a lot of these questions, where God is, who God is, how did we come, where did children come from, and stuff like that. And most parents
they do something horribly stupid and they shut their children down. They say, you shouldn't ask such questions, or that is stupid to ask.
I think back in the day, parents used to do that a lot. They used to tell them, don't think about these kind of things. When you grow older, you'll know. But now, a child, even at 3 years old, he can navigate his way through Google. He can navigate his way through YouTube. He can navigate his way through... games and stuff like that. So their brains are much more developed than our brains back in the day when we didn't have all these tools.
Right.
So back in the day, you might find a 10-year-old, 15-year-old, he does not know how to operate, for example, a VCR back in the day, you know, with tapes. Yeah. But now you find a 2-year-old, 3-year-old, he can operate an iPad, an iPhone smoothly and flawlessly.
Right.
So that you can see that the gap has changed, the times have changed, people and children's brains and their activity also changed.
But not only that, if I might add, even if the child doesn't understand the answers provided, it encourages them to keep on being curious in pursuit of knowledge.
Yeah.
And that became a staple fact of their life, that they can always ask and receive a knowledge-based answer.
Exactly, exactly. So you don't want them to go ask this question to someone else and get the wrong answer from someone else.
Right,
so
that's also important.
So you keep the questions in the house.
A controlled environment.
Yeah, and you keep them asking all the time. So that's something natural to happen at the age of three.
Right.
Also, for example, at the age of three, a child is more defiant and he has this concept of trying to go against the entire world from the age of three.
Already
to
at the
five.
Age of three.
Yeah, so, you know, he's constantly... arrogant, he's constantly not listening, he's constantly defining.
So they are small rebels, basically.
Yeah, so this also natural. Most parents, for example, this age, when they see their children from the age of three to age of five and they find their kids being very defiant, they take that as a way of a child being hatred, the child trying to, I don't know, attack the parents and so on and so forth.
Right. Dear Sayyid, we will go on a quick break.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, "He who has a child must treat him in a childish manner."
Ya Welcome back to your listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are talking about the ages of 3 to 5 years old and how this phase is characterized by the child being a little rebel and being very defiant and also loving to be curious and asking questions. Did you say it? Please pick off where you left off. Thank you.
So when a child is at this age between 3 to 5 and he has this tendency to be more defiant towards his parents and towards people around him, we shouldn't take that as a sign of him trying to seek revenge or him trying to, I don't know, be bad or hateful or resentment towards his parents. No, that's just a phase of his life he has to go through. So this is the time, through 3 to 5, where he just goes against everything, right? So
some say that this happens again in the teenager phase.
Yeah, it continues. Sometimes this kind of thing continues. If this is what we say, that's what we're trying to say, is very important for parents to understand that if the parents don't deal with it based on what it is, it will continue. Because sometimes when a parent deals with a 4-year-old, 5-year-old child who is defiant, and they become defiant too.
Right.
So the child is defiant, I'm becoming defiant, I'm increasing the problem.
Yeah.
But if the child is being defiant, I need to be more flexible. So he kind of gives up. Yeah,
right.
De-escalate the situation, and he gives up this habit. The more parents increase their defiance with their children,
they escalate the situation.
It grows with them.
Right.
It becomes, as we say, muhkam. It becomes very strong, embedded in them now.
Right.
So they become teenagers, and they're more defiant. Why? Because from a young age, you let it become part of them.
Right.
And instead of looking at it as a phase that a child goes through. So a child, we need to encourage that in a child. A child needs to be defiant in order for him to survive in the outside world.
Right.
It's a defense mechanism.
Because, funny enough, all these phases that you're mentioning about how the child is developing, some of these traits are like qualities and necessities of life if you want to be successful.
They are. So being defiant is a good thing for a child as he grows older. If it is, used correctly, if it's nurtured correctly, if it's the parents understand it for what it is. Because like I said, most of the parents, when they see their children at this age, I've seen many parents, like they start to yell at their kids, they scream at their kids, hit them, punish them just for being defiant. It's just natural for them to be defiant. Just go with the flow. Deal with it based on what it is.
Be patient.
Right? Be patient. Try to work with them.
Right.
If you see the child being defiant in something, if it's something wrong, find a way to teach them, educate them, and try to absorb the problem and solve it in an easier, nicer manner. Not by going head-to-head with the child or just giving straightforward orders. Don't do. He doesn't understand that yet. He doesn't understand these concepts yet. So it needs to be, taken into consideration.
Right.
And a child needs to work, a parent or an educator needs to work with a child in this regard. Now, a child goes, also from 3 to 6, for example. A child's mind is the sharpest, right? Children would remember things that happen at this age. So parents also need to be careful and mindful that what they do around the child and say around the child will stay in their heads.
They remember.
They remember it.
Yeah.
That's why even in Islam, for example, says when it comes to children, make sure that, you don't let them sleep in the same room. You don't let them see certain things, certain actions. Even the Quran talks about this kind of concept. Because children, these things, from 3 to 6, their minds are very sharp. They remember everything they hear and they remember everything that they see.
Right.
So what you do in front of a child from this age will stick with them. Right. Now, even Mia knew that if we go back to this period of our life, you would find out that you remember a lot.
We have some memories.
Especially if things happens in the house. So sometimes outside events, because there's so many, you don't end up remembering too much. But events in the house, you find out that you remember them the most.
And on that thought-provoking note, we must end today's program. Dear Sayyid, I thank you for your time today and for your insightful knowledge. And I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If our dear listeners have any questions, comments, or some feedback that they want to give us, they can find us at our website, parstoday.com, or they can write us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. Alternatively, they can also find us on our various social media accounts under the call sign of Call of Islam Radio. Dear listeners, thank you for tuning in yet again.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. We have an interesting story for today. A young man was proud of his healthy and beautiful heart. One day, standing in the middle of the town, he proclaimed that he had the most beautiful heart in the whole valley. A large crowd gathered to have a look at his heart. His heart was smooth, shiny, and looked very healthy. Indeed, the man had the most beautiful heart in the valley, everyone agreed. The proud young man felt delighted and boasted his perfect heart, which everyone admired. Suddenly, a voice from the crowd said, "Your heart is not as beautiful as mine." The young man searched for the person, and an old man appeared in front of him. "Show us your heart if you believe you have got more beautiful heart than mine," said the young man. The old man carefully showed his heart. The crowd and the young man looked at the old man's heart. The heart was beating strongly and healthily, but it was not smooth and shiny as the young man's heart. Instead, it had scars all over it. It had places where some pieces of the heart had been removed and other pieces were put in. The other pieces didn't fit perfectly, and there were several uneven edges. In some places, there were deep gouges where some pieces were missing. The crowd laughed at the old man's heart. How can he claim that he has the most beautiful heart when it is all scarred and uneven? They thought. The young man looked at the old man's heart and laughed. You must be kidding. Compare your heart and mine. My heart looks perfect and smooth, and yours is a mess of scars and tears. Yes, your heart looks perfect, but I would never trade your heart with mine, said the old man. Every scar in my heart represents a person whom I had given my love. I tear a piece of my heart and give to them. Often my loved one gives me back a piece of their heart, which fits into the empty place in my heart. Since everyone loves each other in a different way, their piece of heart may not perfectly fit my heart, so you can see some rough edges. These scars and rough edges remind me of the love we shared, he continued. Sometimes I would give a piece of my heart, but the other person may not return a piece of his heart to me. These are the empty gouges. Although these gouges are painful, these remind me of the love I have for these people too. So do you now see what a true beauty? Asked the old man. The young man and crowd stood silently, with tears running down their cheeks. The young man walked to the old man, reached into his perfect, young and beautiful heart, ripped a piece out of it, and offered it to the man with trembling hands. The old man gratefully received, placed it in his heart, and then took a piece from his old heart and placed it in the young man's heart. The young man looked at his heart. It did not look shiny and smooth like it used to, but it was now more beautiful because he could feel the love from the old man's heart flowing into him. Sayyid Hussein Al-Ghazwini.
One of the most sensitive topics to discuss is the topic of love. There are many that spend a lifetime in pursuit of true love, to find the one that they truly love. There are some people that commit all sorts of sins and haram acts with the excuse that they are in love. It's as if love justifies everything. It justifies committing sins. It justifies committing haram, sins that are very big in the eyes of Allah, because they are in love. There are some that think love is fake. It doesn't exist. It's only something in our minds. There's no reality to love. There are others who believe that love is the drive behind everything that human beings do. Is love a good thing or a bad thing? It depends on who you ask, which philosopher, which thinker. There are some that think love is fake. It doesn't exist. It's in people's imaginations. It's something that was made up for economic reasons, for consumerism, to make money, to get money from people's pockets. How? By making up something called love, so that people go on dates, they buy gifts, weddings, spend money on flowers, spend money on chocolates. There's Valentine's Day, and it's a time for the economy to receive a boost. It's nothing but consumerism. It's nothing but an idea to boost the economy. This is on one hand. On the other hand, there are other thinkers that believe love is the drive behind every single human behavior. The reason why we go to school is because of love. The reason why we get a college education is because of love. We want to get married. We want to impress someone. The reason why we go to work and make money and buy a nice house and buy a nice car and drive the nicest clothing and put on makeup and wear the nicest dresses, it's only for love. Only to either find a new love or maintain the love that we have. Every human behavior, the main drive behind it is love. So as you see, there is a wide spectrum of theories on love, and the truth lies somewhere in the middle. And then you have Hollywood's version of love. And this is where things become catastrophic. Hollywood gives us the image that life revolves around love, not love of country, not love of God, not to contribute and achieve or do something for your faith or your country. No, life revolves around love, and that you should sacrifice everything for love. Even if you love a complete stranger, if you fall in love with a complete stranger, you should sacrifice everything you have for the stranger. Even if you're married, even if you have a wife and children and a fantastic job and a lovely house, but if you fall in love, you pursue love. Even if it means you have to move across the globe to pursue that love, you sacrifice everything for love. A husband, even if he has a loving wife and children and a nice job, but if he falls in love with someone else, he should sacrifice everything. Or on the contrary, if a woman has a loving husband, children, but she falls in love, she should sacrifice everything for the sake of love. This is the image that Hollywood gives us of love. This is the Hollywood version of love. And that if you don't pursue love, you will live a miserable life, a life of misery, a life of depression, and you will never be happy if you don't pursue true love. This is the image. When you watch a Hollywood movie, this is the image that you receive. This is the message that you receive. And this is ridiculous. In Islam, we believe in love. Love is not fake. Love is not just in the head. Love is real. It's very much real. Love is a good thing. It's not a bad thing. And it's something very beautiful. However, but you don't ruin your family over what you perceive as love. And it could be something else. It could be infatuation. It could be lust. It could be simple attraction. You think it's love, and you sacrifice everything that you have for what you perceive as love. This is what Islam does not accept. Islam says, no, this is animalistic form of love. This is blind love that Islam does not accept. Also, another problem of the Hollywood version of love is that they give us the wrong image. It gives us the wrong image. You see the husband, he's romantic all the time. He's always calling his beloved, sending gifts and flowers, and taking his wife or the one he loves to romantic places and so on and so forth. And the wife is so romantic, and everything is all around. Life revolves around romance. And that is how meant, and that is how life is meant to be. This is wrong. This is wrong. This is a wrong image. This is not how life is meant to be. This is not how reality is. But they give you this image. And that is why many people, after watching a romantic movie from Hollywood, they develop a dissatisfaction. They're disappointed with their significant other. The wife comes back home and she says, why can't you be as romantic as the guy in the movie? He's so romantic. Why can't you be as sweet and generous and loving and romantic as everyone else? And I don't know who she's talking about, everyone else. It's just an actor in a movie which is fake, which is meant to distract people. Or the husband is dissatisfied or disappointed with his wife because she's not like the actress in the movie. She's not as romantic as the wife in the movie. And this is very disturbing. It ruins families.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah.
Ala bi dhikrillahi tatma'innul qulub.
Al Mubarak, Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
On the 25th of October, Sudan's General Abdel Fattah el-Burhan imposed a nationwide state of emergency across the country and dissolved Abdullah Hamdok's transitional government and the top ruling body, the Sovereign Council, a joint military-civilian power-sharing authority.
First of all, we are declaring a state of emergency. Second, we are dissolving the Sovereign Council and removing the state governors. We remain committed to the international agreements signed during the rule of the interim government.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Now, this week's edition is focusing on the ongoing political crisis in Sudan after the country's military seized power after dissolving a fragile transitional government. Sudan's people have taken to the streets to condemn the coup. In our show today, we are asking, what is the real reason behind the coup, and are foreign powers such as the U.S. and the Israeli regime involved in fomenting Sudan's political turmoil? Stay with us until the end of the show for the answers.
Sudan in political turmoil. On the 25th of October, the Sudanese military, led by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, took control of the transitional government in a military coup. Al-Burhan dissolved the military civilian sovereign council that had been established to guide the country to democracy after the overthrow of long-ruling autocrat Omar al-Bashir in a popular uprising 2 years ago. In essence, he staged a palace coup against the government of Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok and the transitional authority he chaired. Some observers believe that the dispute between the civilian and military leaders in Sudan was exploited to divert the main demands of the Sudanese people.
Following the military takeover, Sudan's main opposition coalition called for civil disobedience and protests across the country. Clashes have rocked Khartoum as Sudan's security forces continue with a crackdown on furious anti-coup protesters. Now, to discuss the unfolding situation in Sudan, my colleague contacted Dr. Nisreen El-Amin, a researcher on foreign land grabs and the militarization of borders in East Africa and the Sahel. We also have Adil Abdelati, a Sudanese politician, media activist, and the chairman of the Sudan of the Future political bloc. Now, Dr. El-Amin started by elaborating on what she believes is the real reason behind the military takeover in Sudan.
To answer your question, I would say that there are two reasons that behind this military takeover. One is that al-Burhan, who is the head of de facto head of state at the moment, was and the head of the Sovereignty Council, which was made up of civilians and military members, was scheduled to hand over power over, you know, it was essentially scheduled to hand over power to the to a civilian member of the Sovereignty Council, and he was unwilling to give up that power, in part because of a fear of being indicted for war crimes that he's responsible for in Darfur, but also during the civil war in South Sudan. The other reason is that there have been conversations within the transitional government that have also led to some of these tensions that I mentioned earlier, because much of the economy is still under the control of military members of the former regime, including al-Burhan. So currently 250 companies in the areas of gold mining, for example, flour, sesame, and other kind of industries, if you will, are under the control of members of the military. And Hamdok was very much pushing for those companies to be transferred to the government. And so he, you know, Al-Burhan and his deputy Hamiti stood to stand to lose from that kind of transfer.
The actions taken by Sudan's military have many parallels with Egypt's tumultuous summer of 2013. Prime Minister Hamdok and his cabinet ostensibly had responsibility for the day-to-day management of the government. However, their efforts were often been handcuffed by the structure of the transitional government, which favored the military.
Now, our question is, did the civilian leadership place too much trust in the military without learning from other countries, especially neighboring Egypt?
They have succeeded to eliminate all political forces which demanded the giving power to the civilians and a short transitional period. And after 2 months of negotiation, at the beginning, they planned the massacre of the protesters in the sit-in in Khartoum, where hundreds of people were killed at dawn. So that was a way to force other political parties to accept their role in the transitional government. And unfortunately, some of the political parties, they agreed to this and they became partners to them. They succeeded also to arrange the transitional government to be for 3 years, and after that they prolonged this to 4 years.
Well, the coup came hours after U.S. Special Envoy for the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman, held talks with Sudanese military leaders, and this has raised speculation that Washington was aware or actually supported the military takeover. Of course, the U.S. has publicly condemned the coup in Sudan, but this is seen as just a public relations gimmick. Dr. Nesrin gives her take here on the possible role by the United States in the power grab by Sudan's military.
In October, for example, of 2020, Sudan was removed from the state sponsors list, state list of state sponsors of terrorism. And that removal was tied to Sudan being asked to normalize relations with Israel. And that was kind of under the auspices of the United States to position Sudan as kind of to open it up for foreign investment and to allow Sudan to kind of get in the good graces of the international financial institutions and to be able to take out loans and to have its debt, some of it, most of its debt really forgiven. And so that's kind of where the U.S. has been a relatively new player, if you will, because Sudan has been isolated for so long, having been on that list. And so, you know, Feldman met with Al-Burhan a few hours before this coup happened or began, and says that he's surprised that it happened. At the same time, you know, Al-Burhan had just visited Sisi in Egypt, and it appears that he kind of got the green light to do what he's done. And so what appears to me is that you have U.S. allies in the region like Egypt, like Saudi Arabia and the UAE.
Civilian leaders in Sudan had expressed reservations about the country's normalization with the Israeli regime. For instance, Foreign Minister of the ousted Sudanese Transitional Authority, Maryam al-Sadiq al-Mahdi, downplayed normalization of ties with the Israeli regime. Protesters across Sudan also held demonstrations rejecting the move by the Transitional Authority to normalize ties with the Israeli regime, insisting that they will always stand with Palestine.
Most Sudanese oppose the normalization of ties with the Israeli regime. Well, Mr. Adil believes that the recent coup was most likely instigated by the Israeli regime to pave way for complete normalization.
Israeli factor is very important in this coup. We don't know about direct involvement of Israel in organizing the coup, but they could inspire it or they could promise the military leaders some kind of support. We know that there were a visit from Mossad to Sudan and secret meetings with Al-Burhan and with Hemeti in Sudan and in other countries. We know that there were some kind of intelligence support from Israel to the junta in Sudan. We know that the military leaders, al-Burhan himself and also Hemeti, were very eager to normalize the situation with Israel and to build the diplomatic relations.
While announcing the military takeover, al-Burhan said the military will appoint a technocrat government to lead the country to elections set for July 2023. But he made clear the military will remain in charge in what is seen as following the same script that was used when the military grabbed power in neighboring Egypt.
We're stressing here that the armed forces intend to complete the democratic transition until the country's leadership is handed over to an elected civilian government who can bring these issues to life.
What is the game plan of the military rulers? Can we expect Sudan to move to a military rule similar to the one in Egypt?
The people on the streets have a very clear message that they will not be governed by any government that is formed by al-Burhan and the military remnants of the al-Bashir regime. And I don't think they're going to be leaving the streets until their demands are met. And so, to me, the comparisons with Egypt are not ones I would like to make. I'm hopeful and very proud of the people who are risking their lives on the street, who are defending this revolution. And I do think that al-Burhan and his sort of, you know, and his crew, if you will, that their days are numbered.
Several people have been killed after security forces clashed with protesters furious over the military coup. Well, we shall now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall talk about how the United Nations and the African Union reacted to the coup in Sudan. So stay with us.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Sudan in political turmoil.
The military coup in Sudan has attracted widespread condemnation internationally. The United Nations has led calls for restoration of civilian rule in the country.
The Secretary General strongly condemns the ongoing military coup d'etat in Khartoum and all actions that could jeopardize Sudan's political transition and stability. The Secretary General calls for the immediate reconstitution of the governing arrangements provided under the constitutional document. Sudanese stakeholders must immediately return to dialogue and engage in good faith to restore the constitutional order and Sudan's transitional process. The United Nations reiterates its unwavering commitment and support to the realization of Sudan's political transition. Any attempt to undermine the transition process puts at risk Sudan's security, stability, and development.
The African Union has said it suspended Sudan from all its activities after the country's military overthrew the civilian-led transitional government. The continent-wide bloc said it strongly condemns the seizure of power and was suspending Sudan from all AU activities until the effective restoration of the civilian-led transitional authority. This move by the African Union was similar to other measures in the wake of military coups in the continent.
Mr. Arden believes that failure by the African Union to take tangible action against coup leaders will affect the credibility of this pan-African organization.
The African Union failed the African people in preventing military leaders from gaining power and in dealing with coups like in Mali, like in Guinea, and in other countries now in Sudan. And the position of the African Union is very, very weak. That is because the African Union almost consisted of different countries which are ruled by military leaders. And it is an organization of official countries and official government. So this is that is the reason why their positions are very weak. The Sudanese people are not looking anymore for the African Union to defend them. Rather, they are relying on themselves and on some limited international support.
The transitional authority led by General Burhan had pledged to cooperate with the International Criminal Court, which has issued arrest warrants for Bashir for alleged war crimes in the restive Darfur region. However, the pursuit of justice over Darfur was a point of tension between the military and civilian leaders.
The military has always appeared reluctant in taking action on the thorny issue of handing Bashir over to the ICC to be charged with crimes against humanity. The question many are asking is, will this file be closed after the coup?
I think in many ways, as I said earlier, Al-Burhan has been resistant to hand over power to a civilian member of the Sovereignty Council, in part because he fears being indicted for similar war crimes, right, that al-Bashir has been indicted for by the ICC. And so, you know, in some ways, I think it might be, we might have to sort of think about that file is closed, but it's also unclear. I mean, they've thrown al-Bashir under the bus before, so.
In late 2019, a Sudanese court convicted former President Omar al-Bashir on corruption charges and sentenced him to 2 years of detention in a reform facility. Many analysts, including Adil, believe the sentence was lenient due to the influence of Bashir within the military.
Bashir is a mentor of these generals. He was their commander of chief for 30 years, and they are very connected to him. Also, they are afraid that Bashir will become a witness against them if he's handed to the international criminal law, and he will bring them by witnessing also against them as partners in the crimes. So they will never give him, and they will never give him even a good trial in Sudan for his crimes against humanity, for genocide, and for war crimes.
General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and other Sudanese military leaders have close ties to Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. It's clearly not in the interest of these countries to see a democratic Sudan.
The U.S. is trying to distort and misdirect the popular revolutionary movement in Sudan to prevent similar movements from gaining popularity in Arab regimes allied to Washington. So what role, if any, did regional powers such as Egypt, the UAE, and Saudi Arabia play in the current military takeover in Sudan?
I mean, they're probably the more major players. And I think one of the things to remember is that al-Burhan, he was trained in a military college in Egypt, has strong ties to Sisi, and was always seen as... He also actually played an important role in... supporting the Saudi coalition to fight in the war in Yemen. And so I think at that time we saw al-Burhan and others emerge as kind of more loyal allies to the Saudi UAE-Egypt kind of coalition. And they actually pledged as soon as al-Bashir was ousted, Saudi Arabia and the UAE immediately pledged about $2 billion in aid to support the transitional military council before the partnership and the transitional government was formed. So right there, you see that they've always been very supportive of the military elements of this government.
Well, unfortunately, our time is up for today. I would like to thank our guest, Dr. Nisrin El-Amin, a researcher on foreign land grabs and militarization of borders in East Africa and the Sahel, and also Adil Abdelati, a Sudanese politician and chairman of the Sudan of the Future political bloc. Here at Africa Today, we shall continue giving you an alternative view of events taking place in Africa. And that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. Drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know your views. From me, Mubarak Kenya, it's goodbye for now.
In the limelight. Corporate influence and corruption defines American politics. No wonder most think the country is headed in the wrong direction. We now present you an article written jointly by David Sirota and Andrew Perez. The piece is titled, If Americans Can't Have Basic Things Like Childcare, Their Democracy is a Sham. In 2014, Northwestern and Princeton University researchers published a report statistically documenting how lawmakers do not listen or care about what most voters want, and instead mostly care about serving their big donors. Coupled with additional research documenting the discrepancy between donor and voter preferences, they bluntly concluded that the preferences of the average American appear to have only a minuscule, near zero statistically non-significant impact upon public policy. 7 years later, America is witnessing a very public and explicit illustration of this situation in real time, and the country seems pretty ticked off about it. In the lead-up to Tuesday, 2nd of November, off-year elections, and in advance of the upcoming midterm elections next year. Recently, Joe Biden and Democratic lawmakers have been making headlines agreeing to whittle down their social spending reconciliation bill at the demand of corporate donors and their congressional puppets. The specific initiatives being cut or watered down in the Biden agenda bill share two traits. One, they would require the wealthy and powerful to sacrifice a bit of their wealth and power. And two, they're quite literally the most popular proposals among rank-and-file voters. New polling demonstrates the silencing effect that systemic corruption is having on voter preferences. 82% of registered voters support adding dental and vision benefits to Medicare, and according to survey data from Morning Consult, this is voters' top priority for Democrats' social spending bill. Conservative Democratic Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kirsten Sinema of Arizona have pushed to keep these benefits out of the bill, following an aggressive lobbying campaign by health insurers who enjoy massive profits from the privatized Medicare Advantage program. According to Morning Consult, another top priority for voters is allowing Medicare to negotiate prescription drug prices, with 72% saying they support the idea. Senator Kyrsten Sinema and a few House Democrats backed the pharmaceutical industry managed to block the party's original drug pricing measure from being put into the reconciliation bill. On Tuesday, 2nd of November, Democrats announced they had reached a deal on a drug pricing plan, which Politico, the website Politico, described as far weaker than Democrats' promised legislation. One industry analyst said the deal seems designed to let legislators claim an achievement while granting Big Pharma protection. The opinion poll also found that 70% of voters support including paid family and medical leave for new parents in Democrats' spending bill. Senator Joe Manchin has demanded that this item be cut. After raiding against the Republicans' 2017 tax law for years, Democrats have largely refused to raise taxes on corporations and the wealthy, and their final bill may even end up being a net tax cut for the rich. This, even though President Biden's own pollsters found that raising taxes on the wealthy was the most popular of more than 30 economic proposals they tested during the 2020 presidential campaign. The flip side of all this also appears to be true. Democrats have protected initiatives to enrich powerful corporations, even though some of those measures aren't very popular. One example, subsidies for health insurance plans purchased on the Affordable Care Act marketplace that shower money on for-profit insurers. Morning Consult reports that extending new Affordable Care Act premium tax credits passed by Democrats in March is the lowest ranking of all the health measures included in the poll. The results of this latest middle finger to voter preferences? New polling data shows that almost three-quarters of Americans now think the country is headed in the wrong direction. Taken together, this is the democracy crisis thrumming underneath all the media noise. The day-to-day erosion of democracy by corporations that use a system of legalized bribery to buy public policy, which then erodes Americans' faith in their government. And yet this erosion does not get discussed in a media-directed democracy discourse that focuses almost exclusively on the 6th of January insurrection or Republican efforts to deny election results and limit voting. This is what my 2006 book called The Hostile Takeover, the conquest of democratic institutions by money interests to the point where the world's greatest democracy routinely rejects the common sense policies that the vast majority of voters want and that every other high-income country has already adopted. Hostile Takeover is not just a rejection of the most popular policies, it is also the media discourse itself. The Washington Press is constantly portraying industry-sponsored opponents of majoritarian policies as moderates or centrists, and depicting supporters of those policies as fringe lunatics who refuse to be reasonable and compromise. Meanwhile, there is a pervasive omerta that silences most media discussion of the corporate influence and corruption that so obviously defines American politics. And there is scant mention that the moderate obstructionists are bankrolled by the industries lobbying to kill the popular policies that the American people want. There is some encouraging proof that more and more Americans innately understand the kleptocratic nature of this government and want explicit accountability journalism to uncover it. Also mildly encouraging is the impact of that reporting in the reconciliation bill battle. Democrats tried to get rid of all the drug pricing provisions, but were successfully shamed into adding at least a few of the pathetically weak provisions back in after independent media aggressively exposed the big pharma ties of key lawmakers. It is not a huge victory and not worthy of some effusive celebration of Democrats, because the provisions are watered down and a betrayal of the party's promise to do something a lot better. But it's a minimal proof of concept win. It may at least get the idea of Medicare negotiating drug prices into law for the first time. And as important, it shows that when there is a robust press willing to challenge power, the government can be forced, kicking and screaming, to respond, or at least pretend to respond. It's going to take a whole lot more of the kind of reporting and a whole lot more movement pressure to secure real wins and beat back the hostile takeover. The silver lining here is that at least the takeover is now explicit. The opinion polls show what people want compared to what being excised from the reconciliation bill makes this part of the democracy crisis impossible to deny. And ending that denial is a prerequisite for achieving something better.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
Sheikh Javid Akbari, the researcher on Islamic studies from Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Well, we were discussing some verses from the Holy Quran, and we were discussing domestic violence. The Quran says in verse 34 of chapter 4, الرِّجَالُ قَوَمُونَ عَلَى النِّسَاءِ بِمَا فَضَّلَ اللَّهُ بَعْضَهُمْ عَلَى بَعْضٍ وَبِمَا أَنفَقُوا مِنْ أَمْوَالِهِمْ. The verse is very long, and I don't want to read it until the end, but then there is one word in the middle of this verse which says, وَاضْرِبُوهُنَّ فَإِنْ أَطَعْنَكُمْ فَلَا تَبْغُوا عَلَيْهِنَّ سَبِيلًا إِنَّ اللَّهَ كَانَ عَلِيًّا كَبِيرًا. Now, this is verse 34 of chapter 4. The question is, doesn't the Quran instruct men to beat their wives if they are disobedient? We are discussing this verse in this program, For a Better Life. Of course, the aim of discussing this ayah of the Quran is to come to a conclusion and to drive a conclusion in order for us to live a better life, in order to achieve our goals in our lives. Everyone should stick to moral values understand his responsibility, fulfill his responsibility, and make sure that he or she acts within the framework of his religious and moral obligations. Of course, as I said in one of the previous episodes, Islam sets and fixes everyone's responsibility, everyone's rights and obligations. And if everyone acts according to his